faith will in turn be able to be used to go ahead and build up other people around the kingdom and in the church and in this great city. Amen? So right now, with that, I'd like for all of you to help me in welcoming John Oakes, who's going to teach us tonight on ethical answers in an unethical world. Or something like that, yeah.
Thanks. Is this thing working? Good. I feel like I'm in a church. Could we take the sound down a few levels? Good. I'm used to teaching in a room without a microphone anyway. So anyway, I was asked to teach on what is truth. That's kind of an interesting topic. It's going to be a little different in that we're not going to be using the Bible that much in this lesson. Because we're kind of, in a sense, imagining we're reaching out to somebody who has basically no background in the scriptures at all. Sort of fairly basic topic. You can see that I taught this lesson in Kiev. I don't know, about 3 weeks ago I was there in Kiev in Ukraine. That was interesting. Jesus said, I came to testify to the truth, and Pilate said, well, what is truth? All right, what is truth? You know, there's a few things that I'm concerned about as a believer. We've entered what a lot of people call the post-Christian age. You might have heard that fancy description. When I was, let's say, your age, all right, you could assume somebody would, if you'd said Moses or New Testament or something like that, you could assume somebody knew what you're talking about. But I'm sure at UW, it's not that way anymore. You cannot assume people assume, for example, that there is a God at all, or their concept of God may be an Eastern concept, which is a sort of a pantheism, or they may not accept the concept of an authoritative source of knowledge. They may come from a postmodern perspective. And what I've noticed is, over time, the believers have become intimidated. They've become intimidated as if somehow maybe these other people have a good point or something like that. I'll just share one story to kind of illustrate this. I need a little room to move around here. No problem. I just need some room. All right, great. So this is a few years ago. I was in a van with a bunch of science professors, okay? And, you know, it was a conference going to another venue. And this one lady said, yeah, Christianity, what a stupid religion. I can't believe anybody believes that stuff. And what she's assuming is everybody in that van is with her on this, you know, obviously, because we're a bunch of educated people. So we obviously understand that nobody here actually takes religion seriously. See kind of the assumption there? She's there. Yeah, it says in the Bible, if you wear clothing with two or more materials, capital punishment. What kind of stupid religion is that? All right. So I said, excuse me, but the Bible doesn't say that. She said, yes, it does. I saw it in a website. So I said, no, actually, the Bible doesn't say that. I said, you know, people say the Bible's full of all kinds of science errors and no scientist could ever believe in it. I said, I've read it through half a dozen times. I haven't found a science mistake yet. I don't know what they're talking about. Can you imagine how quiet it got in that van? All right? And then I said a quick prayer because I need to find that scripture. Now, could you find the one? Could you find the one? First of all, what book would it be in? Leviticus. Very good. Now, I didn't know chapter and verse, but I remembered it was on the right-hand side about halfway down. So I'm like, all right, good. Found it in about 5 seconds, and I read the verse. But anyway, the point is this, that I believe that we as believers have become intimidated in kind of in intellectual circles, as if somehow, people like this woman, they got this bully pulpit. And I feel like we just sort of conceded. We conceded the voice at the university and the intellectual circles. So I want to talk a little bit about how I believe we can approach this kind of thing. I'm going to be using what I call a worldview approach. Here's an interesting one. We're going to be talking about naturalism, postmodernism. Talk about some other worldviews. I like this statement by Dallas McCown. Typical that you see. Christianity is scientifically unsupported and probably insupportable, philosophically suspect at best, disreputable at worst, and historically fraudulent. All right, let's stop right there. All right, this is an atheist. He's a biologist, an evolutionist. And he says, Christianity, is, from a scientific perspective, it's totally bogus. I mean, obviously. And my response to that would be, well, so can you tell me any science errors in the Bible, like even one? I mean, which? What are you talking about? Let me see. Philosophically suspect at best. Now, I'm going to talk about that tonight. My subject tonight will be sort of looking at Christianity from a philosophical perspective. And then historically fraudulent. Full of a bunch of fables, fairy tales, and a bunch of stories people made up. Really? Really? So can you give me some examples of things that it says happened in the Bible, and we know from historical sources that it's not true? Do you have even one of those things? So anyway, I'm going to talk about the middle of those points and talk about from a philosophical perspective. So we're going to talk about worldview. Eventually, we're going to be in Acts chapter 17. Like I said, we're not going to spend a lot of time in the Bible specifically tonight, because our audience is a person for whom, if you open the Bible, they're like, oh, never mind. because they don't accept a source of authority. And so you're opening it up as if they should read it and believe it. And you might as well talk about leprechauns and fairy tales. All right? So a worldview is the perspective one uses to process and interpret information received about the world. So the world, your worldview is sort of like the glasses you look through at the world. So you see something and you say, here's what it means. Everybody has a worldview, even if they don't think they do. You ask somebody, what's your worldview? They, I don't know. Well, then what you could do is start asking them some, yes or no questions. You'll find out what their worldview is. Now, I believe that, I assume anyway, the majority here have a theistic worldview. All right, the idea that there's a universe created by a God, and being a theist as opposed to a deist, we believe that God intervenes in this world. I'll talk about the Christian worldview. James Sire, an expert on this topic, said a worldview is a set of presuppositions which we hold about the basic makeup of the world. So what I want to do is I want to talk about the atheist worldview, the postmodern worldview, the Muslim, the Islamic worldview, the Buddhist worldview. I want to talk about different worldviews. And I want to kind of do an analysis, what I think is a fairly objective analysis. Now, I'm going to base my analysis of the worldview on these three parameters, if you will. All right, so what would make a worldview a good one? All right, it would just kind of have a fair analysis. Well, first of all, it should be true. In other words, if your basic belief about the world is wrong, I don't know. That's kind of a bad place to start. So we're going to look at the postmodernism, we'll look at materialism, at Buddhism, etc. We're going to ask, is this basic assumption, is it consistent with reality? Because true, for us, the definition of true would be it's consistent. In other words, here's what we observe, here's what we know, all right? And then this says such and such, and if they're inconsistent, then it's not true. All right, next is, does it answer the questions that people really care about? Let's talk about that. All right, for example, what am I? I mean, what am I? And we'll talk about that. What is my value? What is my place? What's my purpose? What's the right thing to do? Where did I come from? Where am I going? What's the ultimate reality? So a good worldview answers those questions in a way that's satisfactory, and that's consistent with what we know. Now, you can kind of guess, since I am a Christian, that my final conclusion is going to be that the Christian worldview passes these tests. But I want us to take, hopefully, a fairly objective view on this. Let me go back. The third one is, those who ascribe to this worldview, we could reasonably assume, would make them a better person than they would be if they ascribed to a different worldview. I mean, clearly, if your worldview makes you not be as good of a person, That seems like it's not as good of a worldview. It seems obvious to me. Now, somebody might say, well, that's all subjective. How do you really, what do you mean by a good person? I mean, everybody's got a different view on that. I disagree with that. I believe you could put a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Hindu, an atheist, postmodernist, a Christian, and add another couple ists or isms or whatever in there. Put them in a room, say, you can't come out until you've come up with a list of five qualities that makes a person be a good person. I believe that would be an easy task. I think they, within 20 minutes, half an hour, they pretty much reach a consensus. A person that's fair-minded, a person that cares about others. You know, you could come up with a list. So again, we're going to subject these different worldviews to these three criteria. Got that? Is it true? Does it provide satisfactory answers that are consistent with what we know? And can we reasonably conclude that a person who held to this worldview would be, in quotes, better than if they held to a different worldview? Now, we're first going to look at a materialism, or, you know, technically atheism is debatable whether atheism is a worldview, so naturalism or materialism. Now, most of the people we meet don't have this worldview. At the university, you meet quite a few of them, though. And in my job, I meet a lot of them, you can imagine. I teach chemistry, I teach physics. By the way, the PhD is in chemical physics, whatever. It's just whatever. Who cares? It's to some degree that I got a long time ago, okay? But anyway, so let me define this. Like I said, the people in that van, in that little van, that woman was assuming everybody in that van held to this worldview. Obviously, because anybody who doesn't is probably kind of an idiot, or, you know, they just don't understand science or something like that. So it's the belief that the only reliable or valid instrument to decide what is true is the scientific method. So according to materialism or naturalism, or sometimes called scientific materialism, the only things that are real are things that can be measured and observed. Unobservable things are simply not real. Now, if this is true, then according to this worldview, there's no basis for morality. There's no basis. The supernatural is by definition not real. And a bunch of other things are applied by this. Here's Richard Lewontin, a well-known atheist, defined materialism. He says, we exist as material beings in a material world, all of whose phenomena are the consequence of material relations among material entities. In a word, the public needs to accept materialism. By the way, materialism is not money, money, money. That's another kind of materialism. That's a big problem as well, right? But that's not a philosophy. An attitude, I guess? What's materialism? Anyway, which means they must put God in the trash can of history, which such myths belong. So the materialist dismisses the supernatural as not real by definition. Now, let me ask you a question. Is stating something to be true by definition a good argument? No, that's a terrible argument. We're going to see that this is really circular reasoning. You might have heard of Richard Dawkins. He's a rather strident materialist. He said, in the universe of blind physical force and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt, others are going to get lucky. You won't find any rhyme or reason to it, no justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. DNA neither knows nor cares. It just is, and we dance to his music. So we're going to ask, is this true? Does it provide the answers to the questions people care about? And if we hold to this worldview, can you reasonably conclude that a person who held to this worldview would be a good person? All right? But anyway, it certainly represents that idea. So to sum it up, only that which can be observed and measured through the technique of the scientific method is real. Everything else is unreal. All right? So, for example, love. There's no such thing as love. That's, you know, that you can't measure it. You can't observe it. So a lot of things that we hold to be fairly obvious, according to this worldview, simply are, that the fancy word is epiphenomena, which is, it only appears to be real, but in fact, if you look carefully, it's not real. All right, that's enough on that. Okay, good. Now, I'm going to argue that this is not true. It doesn't answer the questions that people actually care about, and it doesn't make a person be a better person. All right, now, the scientific materialists seem to assume that it's obvious. This is obviously true. And in fact, people who believe in higher realities, they might as well believe in the tooth fairy. I assume you've come across this attitude, yes? No? Nobody has? All right, some people have, all right. I see it a lot. All right, first of all, it's based on circular reasoning. Now, let me talk a little bit about science itself. I teach a philosophy of science course. And the very first thing I do the first day is I talk about what are the fundamental presuppositions of science. In other words, what if science is a worldview, which it could be or could not be. I'm a scientist. I don't take the materialist worldview. But what are the basic assumptions of science? Assumption number one is that invariant scientific laws govern the physical world. Well, where did that come from? Well, let me tell you where it came from. It came from Christianity. All right? In other words, there were some theologians, I could give you names and dates, Roger Bacon for one, 1250s, who said, well, there exists a single invariant God who created the entire universe, and that universe is beautiful, it works, you know, it's orderly. So he concluded there has to be a single set of laws that are unchanging in time and space, that are basically determined by that creator. Another assumption of science is that the universe can be understood. All right? In other words, if you can't understand the physical universe, why bother studying it? So scientists assume this. Well, why do they assume this? Guess what the answer is? Well, same as the first question. So why do scientists assume that the universe can be understood? Answer is, because of Christianity. I mean, that's a historical fact. All right, you have to understand that before the scientific revolution, humans saw the world as essentially chaotic and governed by forces over which we had little, if any, control. You know, that's why they did all these sacrifices and stuff. But somebody says, no, actually, the God who created the universe wants to be known by us, and he reveals himself through his creation. Therefore, we should be able to understand that creation. And let me ask a question that I believe the materialist cannot answer, which is this. Why is it that we can understand the universe? I mean, if you take naturalism as your philosophy, how can you explain the fact that we understand the universe? Random molecules bump into each other, now we can understand the universe? Seriously? All right, so I believe that this worldview is based on circular reasoning. How do you know that the only things that are real are things that are measurable? Now, I was watching a BBC program a few years ago, and what it was is kind of like they had a panel of, I don't know, smart people, I guess, and they're interviewing people, and so they had a theist and an atheist. And the atheist guy walked out there, he was so forgive me, but he's so arrogant. He's a chemist. It's kind of embarrassing, you know. But anyway, and he makes his opening statement. He says, the only things that are real are things that can be measured and observed. All other things are not real. And they asked him, well, how do you know that? Well, he said, well, the Christians, blah, 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 and the Crusades, and the terrorists, blah, blah, blah. That was his answer. And they said, excuse me, we asked you, you made the statement, the only things that are real are things that can be observed and measured. And we asked you the question, how do you know that? So please answer our question. Blah, 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 Christians this, and more, ethics that, blah, blah, blah. And then they said, excuse me, but in this situation, we ask the questions, you give the answers. If you're not going to answer our question, you have to leave, and we'll just bring in the next person. So tell me, how do you know that? He said, well, I guess I just believe it. Oh, in other words, you accept it on faith. Ah. So the basic assumptions of science are accepted by faith, and they happen to come from Christianity. That's a historical fact. So that's interesting. Oh, this slide, I'm going to go through this slide. It's just recalling what happened at that BBC thing. And I say it is simply not true. Let me ask you a question. It's a trick question. I'm doing it on purpose, though. And I asked this in my, because we do a little section on science and religion in my philosophy of science class, and I asked the students, all right, two choices. I am a body or I have a body. All right, which is it? I am a body or I have a body? Everybody with a lick of common sense gives the correct answer, which is, I have a body. Well, if that's true, then materialism is nonsense and it's just wrong. Now, if you accept materialism, instead of saying to your husband or wife, I love you, you should say, I chemical you. I neurotransmitter you. Because love is simply an epiphenomenon. What about justice? If you take the materialist perspective, then justice is virtually impossible to even define. Okay, what about morality? Because if the materialist is right, then literally I don't exist. Seriously. If the materialist, because that's one of the basic questions, right? What am I? All right? But, you know, when I say I want to go to the store, that's a meaningless statement. What do you mean I? What's I? I mean, what is I? What is me? According to this worldview, there is you don't exist. I mean, you know, the chemicals exist and the neurons fire the certain patterns and, you know, but when you say I believe, that's a nonsense statement. And I believe, therefore, basically, naturalism is actually the thing that's nonsense. So belief in God is just some unfortunate accident that happened because of evolution. Life has no value. In fact, I'm going to hold off on that, the idea of life having no value, but I don't agree with that. I think actually human life has fantastic value. But there's several reasons why materialism is false. Number one, because the universe was created. Now, who tells us the universe was created? Well, the Bible, for one. How about Hebrews 11:3? By faith, we know the things that are seen were created from things that were not seen. All right? Awesome. All right? And then, what did science discover? That the things that are seen were created from things that were unseen. So what's that unseen thing that created it? But, you know, the atheist is left literally unable to answer that question. And I'm sorry, but that's actually a pretty good question. Okay, why does anything exist? You would think that the naturalist would have an explanation for that. It's a pretty basic question, don't you think? And here's my point. These people laugh at us as if we're some foolish people who believe a bunch of fairy tales. Well, what about that fairy tale? That we just exist. Why? You know, how? They have no answer. And this is better. This is smart. It's better philosophy. Life was created. I'm sorry, but life could not come about by some random chemicals bumping into each other. That's a little bit longer explanation. And but you have to understand that scientists say, well, obviously life was created by a natural process. And where did that obviously come from? It comes from their presupposition, certainly not from the facts. And there's a few other reasons why naturalism is not true. One, because some things are wrong. I'm sorry. It is wrong to murder. It is wrong to sexually abuse children. It's wrong. Another reason I believe that this worldview is not a good worldview is because evil is real. But according to this worldview, there is no good and there is no evil. There's a lot of reasons I reject this worldview because it's simply not true. It's simply not true that the only things that are real are things that can be measured. And why does anybody believe that in the first place? Well, we already saw why. Because they assume it. Oh, thank you very much for your awesome proof of your worldview. All right. Now, let's talk about remember the outline. Is it true? Does it give satisfactory answers to the questions people care about? And can we reasonably assume, just logically, given the presuppositions, that would produce a, in quotes, good person? So, point number one, this worldview really kind of stinks. It really does. Now, how about answering the questions people care about? Now, when I do my philosophy of science course, I put this slide up there this comes straight out of my class. So, science is pretty good at answering questions like when. When did that happen? Now, there's some issues even that come up from the Bible that deal with when something happened. And I propose we should let science have that question. It should get the first go. Because science is good at that question. Where? How many? By what means? How did that happen? Science is excellent. But here's my question. Does anybody care about these questions? Do you really care? In your heart of hearts, how many? Or where? Does anybody care about these questions? Nobody cares about these questions. But it's the only questions that science can answer. Very well. How about these questions? Why am I here? Well, remember Richard Dawkins? It's just an accident. It's just, you're just a random, just random. What do you mean why? Do you mean why as in, you know, these chromosomes and those chromosomes? Or do you mean why as in actually why? Is that the right thing to do? Science is useless. Science basically says that question is meaningless. It does not help us to make any important decisions about what's right. All right, what is my value? Well, according to science, about $3.97. You got some calcium, got some phosphorus, some magnesium, a little carbon. And this is a great worldview. Because we talk about human rights. What's the basis of human rights? Do you know what historically the basis of human rights is? Just fill in the same answer, okay? What's historically the basis for the existence of human rights on this planet? Christianity, of course. Whoever doesn't know that hasn't studied history. Do you think science would produce the concept of human rights? Human rights doesn't even make sense scientifically. In fact, it goes against science to believe in human rights. Because what's the value of a human being? The same as a starfish. And I'm not kidding. Okay, what's my purpose? How about this? Science gives you a purpose. Make as many copies of your genes as possible. Now think about that. If that's a purpose at all, it's debatable, right? But if evolution has a purpose, if it does at all, it's to create as many copies of yourself as possible, right? What could you justify? If that was your purpose, think about the things you could justify. How about genocide of people who are not like you? Who don't have your particular genetic thing going on there? How about, you know, lying and stealing and all those things? Does God exist? Well, I mean, this worldview answers the question by saying no. End of discussion, you know. It assumes. But that doesn't do a very good job of answering the question by simply assuming the answer. You might have heard it said something like this. What about the supernatural? You might have heard it said that because of science, we know that there's no such thing as miracles. Now, that is a nonsense statement right there. That is utter nonsense to say because of science, we know there's no miracles. How does science establish whether there's miracles or not? What does science study? Well, science studies the things that are natural. And the supernatural, by definition, is, well, obviously, supernatural. So how could a scientist, establish whether miracles happen or not? Unless they would analyze it from a perspective other than out of science. So question number one, is it true? No, it's not, because I'm real for... And I do actually love my wife. I actually love her. I don't chemical her. I don't simply... It's not just neurotransmitters being released. Okay? The Bible says God is love. Science says love is actually serotonin, melatonin, and all those things. All right, and then the next question is, can you reasonably conclude that this would make a person better? Well, if naturalism is true, then art, literature, music have no intrinsic value. Justice is meaningless. Human rights have no basis. We need to stop using the word ought and should because those words have no real definition to them. If the naturalist is right, then good and evil aren't real. That really solves all that evil problem right there. You know, any kind of sexual behavior is just equally right as any other. Stealing's probably a good idea. There's nothing inherently bad about genocide. And how about racism and slavery? They make perfect sense. By the way, let me tell you, virtually all atheists and naturalists disagree with all these things. But I believe the reason they disagree with these things is because they've hijacked Christian morality and are using it, not realizing their philosophy undermines everything they actually care about. That concerns me. By the way, it's been tried. I mean, we've done the experiment. We've tried basing cultures and societies on a materialist perspective. All right. I put this slide up in Russia last week or the week before last. I hope I'm not going to get in trouble for putting this up there. I hope they're not going to get mad at me. All right. But, you can see some of the experiments. All right. You know, my friend Mark Wilkinson, he's one of my favorite preachers and talking about the sinful life. He would always say, how's that working for you? You know, how's that working for you? So how'd that Pol Pot thing, how'd that, you know, Red China, how about that French Revolution? How'd that work? How'd that experiment go? Didn't go too well. All right? Well, no wonder the most of the university people just rejected modernism and went for postmodernism as if that's an improvement. And if you go to UW or, heck, probably even you go to Seattle University, probably, I don't know, you're going to see postmodernism or naturalism is kind of a working philosophy there. And those are the two that I guess we're in competition with, mainly. So, obviously, they're better than the Christian worldview because everybody thinks they are because the smart people say it's the good worldview. So let's talk about postmodernism. Now, that's an interesting worldview. Actually, by the way, postmodernism is the worldview that there is no worldview. That's essentially what it is. Talk about confusing. So let's talk about it. So truth, if it exists at all, is the property of culture. There's no absolute truth. So this is the worldview that says all truth is relative. In other words, if enough people believe something is true, then by definition, it's true. And people who take this philosophy laugh at Christianity. I'm sorry. But if you're going to laugh back at them, do it respectfully, okay? But seriously, I mean, come on. This is a better... Remember that slide that said Christianity is philosophically suspect at best? Well, compared to what? Compared to naturalism? Compared to postmodernism? Seriously? And we get nervous when these people say stuff like this. Come on. Yeah, I think you ought to, kind of like in that van, stop the train here. You know, you said this about the Bible. That's a bunch of nonsense. Come on, we need to correct some of this thinking. All truth is relative. It's created by society. There's no ultimate moral authority or moral absolute. By the way, a lot of people make postmodernism some sort of satanic plot. Actually, I kind of like certain aspects of postmodernism. You can even quote me on that if you want. It's okay. Because postmodernism, as a reaction against modernism, the whole scientific worldview, actually, I think it's a move in the right direction. Because postmodernists give credence to all cultures, saying all cultures have value. The scientific perspective is not the only one, that people in Eastern cultures have valid things to say. I think postmodernism does a better job of analyzing history than modernism does. So if we kind of, you know, culture and history, postmodernism is fine. But then when you try to make it philosophy and religion and how to live your life in a worldview, it's very confusing, to say the least. Because if we accept this idea, then we say truth is relative. Now, I don't know, that doesn't work for me very well. So let's say everybody over here says, we don't believe in gravity. And by the way, postmodernists take this view about science. Postmodernists reject science as having unique validity to determine truth. So everybody over here says, we don't believe in gravity. We're against it. We teach against it. We don't accept it. I mean, it's not true. And if you tell us that it is true, then you're stepping on us, and that's not right. You know, we have every right to believe our thing is true, and you don't have to agree with that, but we say gravity's not real. All right, fine, let's step up to a cliff and let's kind of go with your philosophy here. Now, one thing postmodernists are sure about is there's no absolute truth. All right, now, here's a question for a postmodernist. Are you absolutely sure that there's no absolute truth? Now, isn't that self-contradictory? And I don't care what you say. I mean, let's throw it out there. All right, God. Either he exists or he doesn't. You know, and all the postmodern philosophy you want doesn't change the fact that there's two options and they can't both be true. All right, I'm white. All right, I'm white. It's, you know, I'm white. Look at that. I'm not black. Now, you could say that I am, you could, you know, but it's true. And if you don't believe it, there's certain gene markers. You know, you could paint me and, you know, and you could look at it in genes and it'll tell you I'm white, okay? So, as far as I'm concerned, some things are just true. This is a superior worldview to Christianity? Seriously? We're supposed to take these people seriously as offering a better alternative than belief in God, the God of the Bible? Man, I sometimes I wonder how these people keep a straight face. And yet they do, and some of us cower, you know. You ever done this? I admit it. You ever walking down the sidewalk with a Bible and somebody who kind of looks like a smart person or, you know, have you ever done that? You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. I've done that. It's like, oh man, I feel so stupid for having done that. Because, you know what? Hello, Bible. Yeah, Bible. Yeah, please. Come on. Let's talk about your view of the world. Let's compare it to the biblical worldview. By the way, the one thing I haven't done yet, I don't know if you noticed it, I haven't shown you the biblical worldview. I'm going to do that. You should pay attention to me, but sort of ignore me a little bit if you want, and ask yourself, what is the Christian worldview? All right? Could you explain it to somebody who knows absolutely nothing about it? Could you, you know, point A, B, C, D, E, what is the Christian view of the world? And I'll give you a hint, Genesis chapter 1 and 2. Just that's all you need. It's just the whole outline right there. Genesis 1 and 2, the most brilliant treatise on theology ever put together anywhere. Anyway, so postmodernism, true for you, but it's not true for me. That doesn't work very well for me. Meaning is, if it exists, it lies in a community of believers. There's no rational way to discover what the best worldview is. Now, there's two theories about truth. One is called the correspondence theory of truth, which says a statement is true if it's consistent with reality. Okay? We can take that as a reasonable assumption something's true. All right? For example, I exist. All right? For example, this object is real. All right, yeah, that's all right. I could go with that. Or relativism, postmodernism, a claim is made true by those who accept it. Now, there's two possibilities. Truth is either created or discovered. And this is a common sense question that even postmodernists, when you really get down to it, they know they're full of baloney. Okay? So truth is either discovered or created. Which is it? Truth is discovered. The truth is not created. Well, it was created. It was created by God. All right. I'm not going to use any more time up with postmodernism. Is that okay? Do I have permission to go on to the next worldview? Self-refuting. I'm sorry. Some things are just true. You know, either. By the way, so postmodernism is not true, and it doesn't answer any questions because it says there are no answers, or every answer is equally good. Some people say that you're worth the whole universe. Other people say you're worth $3.49. Another person says that the goal in life is to not exist anymore. They're all equally true. All right. Well, that doesn't do a very good job of answering those important questions. And then the question is, would holding to this worldview make you be a better person than you would have been otherwise? You know what the worst enemy of postmodernism is? It's the hero. the crusader. You know who postmodernism hates the most? People like Martin Luther King, who said, "You're wrong." People like Mahatma Gandhi, who said, "The British are wrong." Who's he to say that? I remember I was in Sweden a few years ago in Stockholm. I was giving a lecture at the University of Stockholm. And I was just innocent. I didn't realize. I should have known. I'm in Sweden where postmodernism is like. And I said, I can't remember the exact words. Something like, some things are just wrong. We just, obviously, some things are just wrong. And this one woman, she fell out of her chair. She was having trouble breathing. Because in Sweden, the only sin is to say something is a sin. That's the only real sin. To take a stand that some things are true or not true. And so the moral leader, the revolutionary, says, this needs to change. That is the anti-hero in postmodernism. I don't know. All right, there's other stuff about postmodernism. Now let's talk about the Christian worldview. I'm going to take about 20 more minutes here because I want to briefly compare the Christian worldview to some other religious perspectives. I'm not going to take a lot of time there, but I want to talk about what Christianity says about reality. Okay? A basic, by the way, I made up this list, but I just took it out of Genesis 1 and 2. I mean, that's it. By the time, I'm going to do a brief overview of the Bible. All right? Start taking notes here. So I'm going to summarize the entire Bible. Okay? Here we go. Genesis 1. God created everything and it was good. Genesis 2. God created us so he could love us and we could love him and love one another. Genesis 3 and 4. We messed up really bad. We rebelled. We got kicked out of the garden. Genesis 5 through Revelation 19. God is fixing the problem. Revelation 21 and 22, God fixed the problem. So a lot goes on in Genesis 1 and 2. A lot goes on there. All right, so point number one on the Christian worldview. The physical world is real, created, and good. And I would defend each one of those propositions to the nth degree. I mean, it is real, unlike the Hindu worldview, which says it's not, by the way, and the Buddhist worldview says it's not real. It's created. Well, yeah, thank you, science, for settling that one. And good. The creation is good. It is amazing. It is mind-blowingly, spectacularly good. Right? That's Genesis 1. Right? Good. How good? Genesis 1:35. Very good, actually. Point number two in the Christian worldview is there exists a parallel unseen spiritual reality which is not limited to or defined by physical reality. In other words, there's the physical and the spiritual. Number three, the creator of both, the physical and the spiritual, is the God of the Bible. He's the creator of both. Number four, we are both physical and spiritual. But our spiritual nature is more essential than our physical nature because our physical nature is temporary. All right. Number five, now we're getting to those questions. Remember those questions? Because by the time we finish our Christian worldview, we should be answering each one of these important questions. Where did I come from? Why am I here? What's my value? What's my purpose? What is right? What is wrong? The Christian worldview should be able to summarize it in a very brief, concise way, and it should answer every single one of those questions in a way that makes sense, that satisfies, that works, and is consistent with reality. So what about evil? Although the creation is good, evil exists, and it's real. Why is there evil? The reason there's evil is because God loves us. That's why. And he gave us a choice. And if you think we don't have a choice, then I'm sorry, your worldview is kind of messed over. Besides, you're choosing to say that we don't have a choice. So right there, you're proving yourself wrong. Clearly, we are self-aware. Okay? Therefore, we exist. All right? And therefore, we have a spiritual reality. So all these things are true. They're consistent with what I know, and they make sense. But evil is real, and evil is the result of rebellion. You know, every single thing that God created obeys Him. Every single thing He created. This stuff, it obeys God all the time. The microphone, it obeys God. The only thing that God created that doesn't obey Him is us. So why is that? Because God loves us. That's the Christian answer. Love. The reason we exist is love. And, you know, I don't know if I can give a mathematical proof of that, but it's consistent. It's consistent with everything I know. Number six, this is kind of a list. I could talk about God's qualities, His omniscience, His omnipotence, His justice, His holiness. That's item number six. And, oops, oh yeah, that's right, I forgot to get rid of that slide. All right, and then because of God's justice and His holiness, those who choose to rebel will be judged. And point number eight, the solution to evil. That's that Revelation 21 and 22. The solution to evil, to sin, and to eternal consequences is provided by God, by Jesus on the cross. So that's how I would substitute that. Now remember, I went through that kind of quick, all right? I'll post this. It's at my website already. I'll repost it tonight. You know, kind of look at that. By the way, I just sort of made it up. It's just my little summary. You'd probably have a slightly different summary. But I think it's actually a fairly good summary. I've thought about it quite a bit. All right? And so the question we have to ask, is it true? Does it answer the questions we care about? And can a reasonable person, looking at those things, reasonably conclude that those that hold to this worldview would be better than if they were a postmodernist, an atheist, a fill in the blank? Okay? So, yes, first of all, yes, it is real. It is good. Evil's real too. And despite what natural say, I am real. I have both a physical and a spiritual nature. There is no contradiction between science and Christianity, but I believe there's a fairly obvious contradiction between science and naturalism, which is ironic, given that naturalism takes science as its end-all, be-all. And I believe the Christian worldview answers the questions that people care about in a way that is beyond, it's superhuman in its wisdom. So how did I get here? Well, God made me. Why am I here? Because God wants me to love Him. And He wants to love me, and He wants me to experience love with one another. Where am I going? The Bible answers that question. What is my value? What is our value? According to the Christian worldview, you are more valuable than the entire world. That's how valuable you are. Now, maybe that's wishful thinking, but if it's true, it's pretty awesome. You are more valuable than, you know, this kind of a rich area here. There's a lot of houses. I don't know. What's the sum value of all the homes in within 3 miles of here? I don't know, a few billion? You are way more valuable than all those things put together. That's the Christian worldview. That's pretty awesome. What's my purpose? To know the Creator, to be known by Him. That's the purpose. And I could keep going down the list. And then there's other questions. Why is there suffering? Okay, according to atheism, why is there suffering? Why not? Okay, why is there evil in the world? Atheism, evil? What's that? Well, that really solves that question. Really satisfactory. And we're going to start to compare the Christian worldview to other worldviews. Hinduism falls short. Islam falls short. I say that not to disrespect somebody who believes that religion. I think we need to respect people who believe that, those religions, but have this conversation. So I could go on and on about how Christianity answers the question of suffering. The Christian response to suffering is compassion. That's it. Suffering's not evil, but the Christian response to suffering is compassion. Christianity answers the question of sin in a satisfactory way, and answers the question of suffering, and it answers the question of death. What do we have that we would not have if it were not for Christianity? First of all, science. That is a fact. That if it were not for the Bible, if it were not for Christian theology, we'd have no science. If it were not for the Bible, if it were not for Christianity, slavery would exist everywhere in the world. All right? I would debate with any on that. I mean, how can you debate that? And civil rights would be an unheard of concept if it were not for Christianity. What about women's rights? Before and outside of Christianity, how were women doing in any culture anywhere? Okay? And I would argue that Christians do the majority of all benevolent work in almost every country. I'm going to explain some exceptions. I can explain why. I say Christianity certainly makes a person better. Are you kidding? Compared to postmodernism that says it's all relative? Whatever's good for you, it's not good for me. Whatever, you can do it. If it turns you on, great. Do you want to live in a world where there's no moral compass at all? Is that a better world? Is anybody going to try to defend that? All right. So, like I said, I'm not going to go a whole lot longer, but I want to spend a little bit of time in some other significant worldviews. I assume we bump into Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, etc. Okay. Yes, occasionally. And so I'm going to argue we should take the approach that Paul does in Acts 17. Talk about that a bit. Now, some people say, you know, it's a bunch of different roads to the same place. You know, we're all trying to get it there. You can take the Muslim road, or you can take the Hindu road, or the Buddhist road, or the Baha'i road, or, you know, whatever. They're all going to the same place. That is the biggest bunch of baloney. I don't know. I'm coming at baloney. I've used that word three times already tonight. Help me out. Give me another word here. I don't know. That's a bunch of nonsense. Because Hinduism says your purpose is to not exist. And Christianity says your purpose is to be known and to know God. How can those both be true? They can't. Okay? Hinduism says the universe has existed forever. Christianity says it was created. Well, they can't both be true. You know? Different paths. Now, I will agree that the moral and ethical teachings of all the world's major religions have a fair amount in common. I agree with that. But their worldviews are diametrically and ultimately opposed. You cannot justify the Hindu worldview and the Christian worldview. If one is right, the other one is totally wrong. It's not even within light years of correct. So don't give me this stuff. Anyway. Now, if Genesis 1 is true, then all other worldviews are eliminated. Here's your list. Naturalism, postmodernism, deism, pantheism, animism, polytheism, dualism, all these other worldviews, they're all wiped out. Now, of course, Genesis 1 could be not true. That's a possibility. But by the time you're done with Genesis 1:1, all these other isms are gone. How about this? In the beginning. All right. Well, if that's true, then Hinduism and Buddhism are flat wrong. In the beginning, God. All right. Then Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism, etc. We're down to almost virtually every ism is already canceled out. All right, and then in the beginning, God created. Do you realize the amount of theology there? And the point is, in the beginning, true. In the beginning, God, true. In the beginning, God created. True, all true, because reality says they're true. And you could say they're not true, but fine, go with it if you want. A worldview that's not true. That's, to me, that just doesn't seem like that great. All right, Acts 17. I encourage you later to read Acts 17 and watch Paul interacting with people who hold a different worldview. In this case, Epicureanism and Stoicism. The Epicurean is essentially a pantheist. The Stoic is essentially a deist. The pantheist says God, we are sort of God pervades the universe and we are God, and God is us, and you know, that's kind of like Star Wars, you know, Star Wars philosophy. Or you could go with Stoicism, which basically there is a God. By the way, the Stoics were monotheists, they're deists. So there's a God who kind of set it all in motion, and he's over there doing whatever, and you're on your own, buddy. So what does Paul do? He first of all, he found common ground. He said, look at all these idols. Look at these idols. What a bunch of nonsense. And by the way, the people in his audience were like, amen. Well, not amen. I don't know what they would have said. Good stuff, Paul. He found common ground. We need to find common ground with Muslims. We need to find common ground with atheists and postmodernists. We have a lot in common. We have beliefs and ideas in common. Start there. But then he said, let me show you a better God. To the Stoics, it says we're all alone. He says, no, in him we live and move and have our being. To the Epicurean, who says, oh, he's very distant and unknowable, he says, in fact, he set the very times and places. Who has he not mentioned yet? If you read that sermon, who has he not mentioned yet? He hasn't mentioned Jesus yet. Because they're not going to get it. Paul's kind of backing the truck up a little bit and saying, let's talk about basic assumptions. How do you see the universe? What's your view of it? So let's look at some of these other worldviews very, very briefly. Hinduism. I'm going to skip a bunch of stuff. It began as animism and polytheism, but evolved into pantheism. If you go to India, believe me, it's extremely polytheistic and very pagan. But the version of Hinduism that ends up here is pantheism. So there's all these gods. I'm going to skip all that stuff. There you go, Krishna, Rama, all that. But the basic, sort of the philosophical Buddhism has the idea of Maya, which says the physical stuff is an illusion. Everything you see is an illusion. It's not real. Okay, the ultimate thing is this Brahman, this God nature that pervades the universe. We are Brahman. Brahman is us. The goal of Hinduism is to escape the cycle of karma and reincarnation and to dissolve, to essentially not exist. Okay? The Hindu worldview has you looking inside. The Hindu worldview, you're not looking out there because it's not even real. So where do you find God? Inside of yourself. You are God. Where do you find truth? From yourself. And then we're going to ask you questions like, is this true? Does it provide answers that are consistent, that work? And does it make us a better person? And my answer is no. No. And no. With a straight face, not angrily, not like disrespectfully, but no, it's not true. It's not a better worldview. According to Hinduism, time is cyclic. There's all this details. I have to skip all this stuff. Essentially, the whole wheel. You've heard about the wheel. Here's a Hindu wheel. And there's Brahma creates, Vishnu sustains, and Shiva destroys. Brahma creates, Vishnu sustains, Shiva destroys. Brahma creates, Vishnu sustains. You know, all this stuff. Okay. There's many different levels of reality. We're kind of in here. Down here is more physical, less spiritual. Up here, you know, there's different levels. Well, my question is, are these levels real? Is there any evidence for these things? All right. According to Hindu cosmology, the physical world is illusory. Evil is not real. Okay. Here's a Hindu cosmology. Or you see the different levels, there's all these hells and all these heavens, and we're kind of in the middle there. If you want to see the Hindu cosmology, just go to Angkor Wat. And in fact, you just all the carvings around the side, that's a Hindu cosmology. But the problem with this cosmology is it's not true. To me, that's a problem. Because according to Hindu cosmology, physical things are not real, neither is evil, and the universe is eternal and uncreated. I'm sorry, but that's not true. The universe was created. And I don't care what you say. It seems real to me. And I exist. Does it answer the important questions? Well, I mean, it does. I'll say this. Hinduism does a lot better job of answering the questions we care about than postmodernism. A lot better. A lot better. Back before I started reading the Bible, I was attracted to Hinduism, and not without reason, to be honest with you. At least it provides some answers. But what about the question of evil? It says evil's not real. I don't know about that one. Does accepting this worldview make one a better person? Now, I'm giving such a short treatment here. It's almost would be better to say nothing than to say as little as I'm saying. But who does almost all the benevolent work in India? Christians. 1% of the population. Is that an accident? No, that's not an accident. Because according to Hindu worldview, suffering is not real. And either way, to the extent it's kind of sort of real, the thing to do about it is to ignore it, is to become uninvolved, because basically it's dispassion as opposed to compassion. Now, are there some compassionate Hindus? Of course there are. Are there loving Hindus? Of course there are. But that's not sustained by their worldview very well. Not really. So no, this is not a better worldview, because the bottom line is it doesn't make people better. Sati is not a really good practice. Not really. In fact, it's terrible. And the idea that different people have different value based on who they're born with and the whole caste system, I'm sorry. That is not a better worldview. I don't want to be mean about it. But I think we should have discussions on these terms with our Hindu friends. What about Buddhism? Don't have a lot of time there. The Four Noble Truths. By the way, almost everything I know about Buddha, I like. I like the guy. Other than the fact that he abandoned his wife and children. But if you take that out of the equation, basically he looked at the world, he looked at Hinduism, which is pagan and just so worldly and polytheistic, and all these priests having all this power. He said, "It's terrible." So he decided to go for asceticism and saying physical things are evil, the exact opposite. And he became what would essentially be a Jaina. Then he realized they're both bad. So he found this in-between path, the Four Noble Truths. Suffering is not getting what one wants. The cause of suffering is desire. The way to end suffering is to end desire. Now, that creates problems for me, though. The way to end desire is the Eightfold Path. Right viewpoint, right value, right speech, right action, right livelihood. I like the Eightfold Path. I agree with basically all of those things, by the way. It's a much better worldview than postmodernism. The alternatives offered at the universities, oh, this is way better than those. But how about its cosmology, which, like Hinduism, says the universe is eternal and uncreated? Well, that's not true. It has many, many different levels. There's all these different... I was at a Buddhist monastery in Thailand, and here's the cosmology. I think we're right about here. There's all these other levels, all these other levels. Now, are those real? Is there any indication whatsoever that any of that is true? None! And yet, if you look at the Christian worldview, the essentials, every point on there, it either is obviously true, or it's consistent with everything we know. And I'm sorry, Mr. Buddhist friend, but this looks like an invention. I don't think it's true. And by the way, the Eightfold Path says, do not involve yourself in the world. If you want to advance, you have to ignore your emotions and deny them. And the worst thing you want to have is compassion. No, Buddhism is about dispassion. Does that make a better person? Dispassion? I don't think so. By the way, if you go to Borobudur, which is in Indonesia, this is a Buddhist cosmology, which... It appears outwardly to be similar to Hindu cosmology. It's because it is similar to Hindu cosmology. And it's wrong! It's just not true! To me, that's a problem. And I think we should let our Buddhist and Hindu friends respectfully, lovingly, having found common ground, I think we should inform them of this. Is it a good one? Is it true? All right. Even on the question of evil, just the Christian response to evil and all other worldviews are, forgive me, but kind of bogus here on evil. All right, let's go down the list. All right, atheism, evil? What's that? Postmodernism, you say it's evil, I say it's not. We'll have a vote about that, and whoever, the majority wins. Okay? Buddhism and Hinduism say they're not real. That's your solution to evil? To not deny its existence? Islam says it's the will of God. Oops. Some Christians say that, by the way. They're called Calvinists. All right, so let's our last worldview I want to spend a little bit of time on is the Muslim worldview. And by the way, the Muslim worldview is the closest to the Christian one by far. All right, just so you know. There's this rule in life that the person most like you is the one that you tend to get along with the least well, you know, kind of like the Palestinians and the Jews and all that. But the fact is, of all the worldviews, the Muslim worldview is by far the closest to the Christian worldview. In fact, if I were to go back to this outline, where is it? It's too far back. Let's pretend you know. All right, the universe is real, created, and essentially good. I mean, quite a bit of the Christian worldview is found in the Muslim worldview, but I want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about a few basic differences in worldview. First of all, and according to the Muslim worldview, good deeds are taken away by evil deeds. All right, so it's kind of like a, you know, kind of like this. All right. So I observe Ramadan. Okay, great. Oh, but I committed adultery. All right. But I gave alms. Okay. Yeah, but I lie. I already said that. Whatever. Shh. All right. Oh, I killed somebody in the name of Allah. Shoom. Oops. Salvation by effort. Surah 2, 271 says charity atones for sins. In the Muslim worldview, we earn grace, we earn favor with Allah, we earn salvation, we earn paradise. There are awesome amazingness. So basically, the Christian worldview says you're not awesome and amazing, you're a wretch. Okay? In Islam, salvation is earned through the efforts of those who are pre-selected by Allah to inhabit a very sensual paradise, which seems to be somewhat different from the Christian worldview, to me, anyway. So, who reaches out to who? You know, all other worldviews have us sort of finding and reaching God through our own effort, whatever their concept of God is. And there's two worldviews that say differently. It says God reached down to us. And it's the only one that makes sense to me. All right. To a fairly significant extent, the Muslim worldview gives similar answers to the Christian worldview to the problems, to the questions. For example, why am I here? Because you were created by God. All right. Now, is the Muslim God a loving God? A merciful God, yes. Loving, not so much. Okay, and in Islam, it's inshallah. Everything is determined by God, and we have no role in that. Do we have free will in this religion? It's very debatable. It's really hard to even find the concept of free will in Islam. Also, but I would say this. Remember I said that across the world, Christians do most of the benevolent works, except in Muslim countries. Because one of the pillars of Islam is almsgiving. That's good. It's one of the pillars of Islam, taking care of the poor and the needy, the disenfranchised. And in Muslim countries, generally the poor, the needy, the disenfranchised are taken care of reasonably well. But the problem with Islam is it's illegal to use that to help anybody who's not a Muslim. All right? Now, let's go back to the, does this make you a better person? A religion whose leader was a general and a person who massacred people and had many, many wives and who basically spread his religion through warfare. All right. And a religion that says you can only help people of your religion, people not in your religion, you cannot help them. It is outlawed to help them. Or you can do it, but you're just going against your religion. Does that make somebody a better person? I would argue that it doesn't. Now, this is not a very popular thing to talk about right now. And by the way, many Hindus don't really go with their worldview. And many, in fact, the vast majority of Muslims are peace-loving. Their religion isn't, but they are, and amen for that. Thank you. I'm glad that they are. But I don't think it's a better worldview than the Christian worldview. All right? So, in summary, the theologies of world religions are fundamentally opposed to one another. The whole many paths to the same place is craziness. The Christian worldview is true. It agrees with everything that I know about reality. It answers the questions we care about in ways that are just mind-blowingly, amazingly wonderful. And it's the only worldview that I could stand in front of an audience and say, let's go down the list here. This is the one that makes people what even a Hindu, a Muslim, or an atheist would agree would make somebody be a good person. So what is truth? Jesus says, I am the truth. He didn't say I have truth. He said, I am the truth. And I believe that Jesus is who he said he was because he was raised from the dead. All right, so we're going to do a question and answer session. Yes? No?
Yes.
All right, great. Now, I didn't use the Bible there very much, but I told you I was not going to. I did it for a reason. But if you have a Bible-related question, go for it. All right? Yes? Yeah, James Sire. The thing I like about his book is that it's only this thick and it's readable. That's a pretty good thing. There you go. The Universe Next Door. By the way, if you're interested, we have a 10-hour class on the Christian worldview. Bob Kirka, who's a professor at Lincoln Christian University, we invited him. He taught a class. So we have a 10-hour class on world religions and a 10-hour class on the Christian worldview, 20 hours of instruction. Go to my website. I got some information in back if you want to do a more detailed thing. I'd say this, though. Almost any textbook on world religions will give you a pretty good introduction. And I think you'll find what I'm saying about these religions is, in fact, true. It's not a distortion. We don't do ourselves a favor by creating a straw man version of another religion. If I've done that tonight, I apologize. It was not my intention. Okay, any other questions? Yeah.
What is
animism? Well, animism is... most primitive religions were either polytheism or animism. So animism is sort of this spiritual thing that sort of pervades the universe. So God is in the river, God is in the trees. How about, what's that movie, Pocahontas? Right? So, you know... Yeah, the religion of Pocahontas, more or less, would be animism. And the word anima means soul or spirit. So animism sees basically God is nature. So most ancient religions are either polytheism or animism. I didn't spend time on that worldview because I don't think that's a strain of... certain places in Africa, you heard they have animism there. What's that mean? They worship animals? No, it doesn't mean that. Well, in a sense, it might. But it's not a worldview that we really come across very much. Yes? Okay, so you're asking, what about the question of violence in the Old Testament, right? Yeah, that's one of the hardest questions. But I don't mean to advertise our apologetic certificate program, but, you know, it just so happens. Another one of our classes is titled Answering the Hard Questions. And all the hard questions are theological ones, with that exception. But arguably, that's also a theological question. All right, let me see. Let me get out of here. See if I can find it real quickly. Hard questions. I've got a slide. It's got like a 7-part outline. That's one of the hardest questions. That's a really, really hard question. It might be here. Let's see if I can find it. Should be. Okay. Question of evil. Question of violence. And if there we go. Almost there. There we go. Yeah. So what about all this genocide and killing in the Old Testament? Point number one. If that doesn't bother you, then I don't know what's wrong with you. But if you read 1 Samuel 15, it says to the Amalekites, kill them. Man, woman, children, and cattle. If that's not a problem, when you read that, I hope that bothers you. If it doesn't, what's wrong with you? You've been playing too many of those video games or something. But see, I'm making a joke out of something that's not a joke. So that's a good question. That's a really hard question. All right, but I'll tell you right now, the Christian response to that is certainly not even remotely like the Muslim response. I'll tell you that. So here, I can make this bigger. I'm going like that to click my computer. Okay, here we go. All right. The argument assumes that physical death is in itself is evil. Now, murder is evil, but death is not. So, from God's perspective, the fact that the Amalekites died, that's a fairly neutral thing. Now, Jesus wept, right? Jesus wept. Why did he weep? Because Lazarus died? Is that why he wept? You know what I'm talking about, right? John 11. Jesus wept. Why did he weep? Because Mary and Martha were grieving. So Jesus wept not because Lazarus died. From God's perspective, people dying is not the issue. The issue is spiritual death. The issue is people being separated from God. And the fact that the Amalekites were killed did not change the final place of anybody in Amalek. All right, so, by the way, I've got a how-many-part outline? I don't know, 8-part outline. And any of these parts is not sufficient to answer the question, in my opinion. All right, but the argument assumes that physical death is somehow evil, and it's not true. Sin is evil, but death is not. From a Christian perspective, death is actually good. Murder is wrong. Death is not, and whether or not warfare is wrong, that's another question. But in the Old Testament, clearly it was not considered wrong. Number two, God has the right to judge, not us. And the Amalekites deserve judgment to say the absolute least possibility. Number three, what about the religion of the Amalekites? Their form of worship was to take a baby and throw it into the fire. Awesome. Really beautiful. All right, that was Molech. And then they had Asherah and Baal. Their way to worship God with Baal was to go to a temple and have sex with a prostitute. God was not exactly honored by that. Their religion was absolutely disgusting. And a stenched before God. I think that's worth bearing in mind. What about the children? What about children who grew up in Amalek? What were the chances they would have a relationship with God and would be in heaven? Does it bother you that they killed the children? It bothers me. What about the Jews? Do you think the Jews had PTSD after that? I think they did. This is a tough question. But what about the children? I'm not going to say God did the children a favor by having them killed. I'm not going to go that far. It's not really my place to say that. But I'd say, what about the children? I believe, in the case of Amalek, I'm picking 1 Samuel 15. In the case of Amalek and the other Canaanites, God's love and his justice both required the same thing. And that Israel did that. And yet, God does not like war. In fact, God hates war. But you have to understand that God had a plan. And in fact, this goes back to the whole, I outlined the Bible, Genesis 1. All right, but what I didn't, if we finish the book of Genesis, we find out what the plan is. The plan is to choose a man of faith. And through that man, to create a people of faith and a nation, to give them a place and prophets and law, and to prepare the perfect time, the perfect location at the center of the earth, the perfect time, the Pax Romana, the perfect situation, a language that pervaded, all that stuff. But in order to do that, the people had to have a land. And I'm talking 1,500 BC. They had to have an army and they had to defend that land. God said, all right there, that's it. They were not allowed to go on, they were not allowed to form an empire. And the fact is, the Jews never did. They were not allowed to raid other people. They were not allowed to torture. They were not allowed to defame the bodies. All right. In fact, every single thing God said about war in the Old Testament was to limit it to within a very narrow range. And even that was only because of his purpose, which was to send a Savior into the world. All right. But at the end of this 7-part outline, it still bothers me. All right. I can give you an intellectual answer. It's sinful to take the life of another in anger out of greed or selfishness, but it's not necessarily sinful to take a life in war. Now, how a Christian should view that is a whole other question, which I could answer if you ask. But everything God did to Israel as a nation was to limit their ability to war, to wage war, no standing army, etc. Okay? That's certainly not the case. In fact, if you read the Hadith, the Hadith is the tradition, so there's the Quran. But Muslims don't just believe the Quran, the Hadith. If you listen to them, they quote the Hadith all the time. And there's whole sections explaining how to wage war. And, you know, instructions about battle plans and not taking any prisoners and all that kind of stuff. Muhammad's plan was to create a political empire through which to create this religion. That's the opposite of what the Bible says. So, from a person outside of Christianity, that is a good question. That most questions people ask are like, oh, that's sort of easy to answer. That is a hard question. All right, another couple of questions. Yes. Yeah, like for example, like I said, finding common ground. Because most people in that situation believe in social justice. I believe Seattle is a place where, I respect that, by the way. Seattle is a place where social justice is valued more than other places in our country, and that's a good thing. We could talk about social justice, we could talk about human rights, we could talk about women's rights, we could talk about slavery. And you could say, do you know where those came from? Because you're finding a common ground. And you could ask some worldview questions. So, assuming that they take an atheist perspective or a postmodern perspective, is based on the materialist perspective, how would these ideas come from that perspective? How do you come to the idea of human rights from a materialist perspective? So I think asking some questions. But the point is finding common ground first. And I think we have a lot in common with our postmodern friends. All right? We have a lot in common. So much of what they hold to be important and good is literally, well, not literally, it's hijacked from Christian theology. And I think we can kind of let them see that. All right? So that's one idea anyway. Whoops, there it goes. Nope. Yes. I mean, that's a great conversation to have. I don't know if people heard, but it wasn't a question. It's more like a comment for me to reflect off of. Yeah. Well, the way I tend to handle that is by telling some stories. There's so many great stories that we have as a fellowship. I'm so proud. For example, I've been in South Africa. I've visited the church in Johannesburg. And if you went to Johannesburg in, say, 1988, if you saw a white person and a black person sitting next to each other in public, they tell me, you could walk up and say, hey, brother and sister, good to see you, even if you never met him before. And as a fellowship, I mean, I'm looking around. There's some diversity here. And to be honest with you, from many things the world values, Christianity is an embarrassment. The typical Christian response to homosexuality is an embarrassment, you know, etc. So the fact that we practice social justice in our church is something we should be proud of. And I think it does open us up to engage these conversations and smash some of these unfortunate stereotypes that non-Christians have about us, because that's not us. Yeah. So being like Jesus is really important. And it's a sad truth that so much of Christianity today is not behaving particularly like Jesus. And we have to deal with that, unfortunately. But I think just telling stories is a great thing. And just having come. By the way, when I was in high school, I was a, you know, druggie doing a stupid, don't tell any kids here. Anyway, but then I became an atheist. But then later on, I became a believer. So I was searching. So I'm believing in God. So I become a vegetarian, and I'm Hinduism. Yeah, awesome. Buddhism, cool. You know what did it for me? I walked into a church like this, and I saw people loving one another. I'm like, oh my goodness, the thing I was looking for, I found it. So I think, just if we just be like Jesus, people will figure it out. I really believe that. But the problem is we have to actually be like Jesus. But unfortunately, a lot of the Christian ways of acting are not very Christian. Yeah. It's a sad fact. Yeah. Go ahead. Right.
Even though the worldview says anything is okay and right, why do materials still today are usually moral?
Right, because they come from a culture that, although we're post-Christian, we're post-Christian, as opposed to post-whatever. And so it's a little bit frustrating that these people don't realize where their values come from. They're clueless about that. And it's kind of hard to explain that, but I think you need to find a way to explain it. So and in fact, we go into that in our class on Christian worldview. We go into that in quite a bit of detail, because you can't sustain the idea of morality. By the way, atheists can be ethical. Ethics is separate from morality. So, in fact, that's one of the common grounds we can find. Really, you could argue that human rights is ethics, not just morality. And getting rid of slavery is ethics as well, okay? There's nothing about atheism that prevents you from behaving ethically. Because ethically is a cost-benefit analysis. Arguably, it involves numbers, you know what I'm saying? Morality is the problem. And so I think we can engage our postmodernist or our atheist friends on ethical level, but then at some point you need to help them see ethics ends and then morality begins at some point. But there's a big difference there. The idea of moral truth is something that clearly the world is all messed up on. But to the extent that the Christian worldview is still it's kind of in the air. And people don't realize that, so I think we should let them know that. We should help them to realize that truth. All right, yes. Yeah.
What's your view
Well, the earth is obviously old. I mean, you can tell that it is. And so if the Bible said the earth is only a few thousand years old, that would be a problem because it's clearly not. But it doesn't say that. All right. And in fact, even Philo, the Jewish philosopher of the first century, he's reading Genesis 1. He's saying these are obviously allegorical. It's describing the process God did. It's not, we shouldn't take it literally as being 7 24-hour periods. All right. And Genesis 1 is a theological treatise. As far as evolution goes, since God invented it, I'd say, thank you, God. That's an awesome idea. The fact that evolution exists is evidence against atheism. It's like in your face evidence against atheism. All right, and so, by the way, I don't think that it's purely just random stuff that's going on. I believe that God intervenes, but that's I can't prove that. We have to be careful when we say things. When we're speaking scientifically, we should be aware of that. When we're speaking in a way that's not scientific, we should be aware of that. Design is not a scientific idea. All right, you can't do an experiment to test to measure its level. You can't prove it. You can't disprove it. But I'm convinced that random processes would not produce what we're seeing right here. There's just no way. In fact, it borders on irrational. However, so I'm an interventionist, if you will. They call it progressive creationism. I think I veered away from your question here. Anyway, the idea of the young earth is not stupid or ridiculous. I'll say that. For example, Jesus made fish, right? How old was it? 1 microsecond, but it looks to be a few years old, all right? Was Jesus lying? Was he deceiving, you know? Jesus made wine. It's ready to go, you know? It's fermented already. You know, he kind of skipped all those processes, you know? So here's how I handle it in my... I teach this intro scientific thought. And so I have a lot of conservative, right-wing Christians in my classes. It's just that area of San Diego. We got a lot of those, and they're awesome. I love them. They're great. But I'm well aware that many here accept the young Earth theory. Now, according to scientific evidence, how old is the Earth? And 4.5 billion. And then I say to them, well, does that mean the Earth is that old? And even the non-believers say, no, it doesn't mean that. It just means that's what the evidence says. Thank you very much. We've learned a few things in this class. Okay, good. So we understand that's just that's what it's implied by the evidence, and that's all we can say. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about the young earth theory. But what I'm going to do is I actually walk to the other side of the stage. So I'm going to leave my role as a scientist, and I'm going to walk over here, and for a minute here, I'm going to pretend that I'm a theologian. I don't tell them I'm sort of a... I sort of am a little bit, but they don't know that. All right, so we're dealing with theology now. All right, great. Now let's just set as an assumption there exists an all-powerful, all-knowing, all those omni things, God. Okay. Now, could that God create the universe so that it appears old? Well, yeah. I mean, obviously. Okay, good. Well, then all that's left is whether he did or not. Okay? So, and does it really matter? I don't think it matters. Well, it may matter on some level. Theologically, it doesn't matter. But then I go back over here and I say, well, yeah, I mean, I agree with that. But if that's true, don't claim it appears young. Please, that's the problem with the young earth creationists. They say it appears young. That's nonsense. It does not appear young. I don't know. I've hiked down the Grand Canyon. If that's young, then I'm confused, okay? You know? So anyway, let's say you look through a telescope at a galaxy that's a billion light years away. Okay? So the photons are hitting your eye. How long ago did those photons leave that galaxy? I'll give you a hint. It's 1 billion light years away. So how long ago did that light leave that galaxy? 1 billion years ago. So how old is that galaxy then? Well, at least a billion years old, obviously. Alright? Fine. So how do you explain that? Well, could God have created the universe now and just sort of put the light sort of already in transit? He could! And who am I to say anything different about that? I don't agree with that. But please don't tell me the universe appears young, because it just doesn't, okay? And so then the question is, how's that work with Genesis? Well, Genesis 1 says, first there was light. Thank you very much. Science says that. Then it says there was the earth, and it was covered by water. Science agrees with that. Then it says land emerged from the water. Science agrees with that. Then it says life appeared first in the water. Science agrees with that. And then that water seems to have changed the atmosphere of the earth to the point where you could actually see the sun and the stars. Science agrees with that. Then life on the land. Last of all, us. So where's the scientific error in that? I just don't see an error in that. So that's how I respond to that. All right, we've got kids here and all that, so I think maybe two more questions. I mean, I could keep going, but all right. Yes, back there. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Now, first of all, the way I did it here is not how I'd do it in that conversation. I think it's a lot better to do it by asking questions. So according to your cosmology, there's this, this, and this. Now, do you actually believe that? And, you know, and what's the basis for believing that? So I would kind of ask them, by the way, does the Bible teach different levels of heaven? What verse am I thinking of? 2 Corinthians 12. No, it doesn't teach that. He says I was in the third heaven. But you have to understand, to the Greeks, the first heaven is the sky, the second heaven is the stars, and then the third heaven is heaven. So when he says I went up to the third heaven, he's just saying I went up to heaven. Now, are there levels in heaven? I don't know, but the Bible doesn't address that question. So anyway, I think we need to be very gentle about these things. I said things in fairly bold ways. You could give the tape to your Hindu friend. It's okay. But, I think asking questions, asking them what they believe and why and what's the basis for that. Let me give an example. I posted a thing on my website where I said that, because you know, there's all these God-man myths, and you know, people say that the New Testament writers made up Jesus is like the God-man, the other God-man myths. And I said Jesus is real and Krishna is a myth. And so this guy, quite respectfully, was hurt, not like angry, but hurt, and maybe a little angry, but not a lot, saying how could you say that Krishna is a myth? He's a real person. And I wrote back, I said, well, I can tell you the year Jesus was born, I can tell you the year he died, I can tell you where he was born, where he lived, where he spent his adult life, I can tell you the name of his mother, his father, 25 or 30 of his best friends, how he died, and many of these things, in fact, most of them are verified historically from outside of Christianity. So I asked him, so when was Krishna born and where? And it took him a while to get back to me. He said, somewhere between 2000 B.C. and 3000 B.C. That's not very exact, you know. And in a place, a city, that there's no equivalent place that in other words, a mythical city. And so, you know, to me, it didn't require any further comment. Krishna is a myth. There's no person Krishna. It's an obvious myth. And when you read the myth, you're kind of reading it, you're kind of going, this is a myth. By the way, did you know that the Bible has myths? Yeah, true myths. Because what is a myth? A myth is a simplified story to explain a deep fundamental truth. That's what a myth is. So there's God-man myths. The Christian one happens to be the one that's true. There's creation myths. The Christian creation myth happens to be the one that's true. There's even flood myths, right? All ancient cultures have flood myths. But the Christian one happens to be the one that's true. But be careful when you quote me when you say that I said that the Bible has myths. Make sure you explain that before you say that to anybody. All right, one more. Okay.
Do you find it helpful to start these conversations kind of distinguishing
No. Not if you're having a worldview discussion. Because what you're presenting is the Christian worldview. And then you can say, by the way, I know a lot of Christians do this, this, and this, but that's inconsistent with the Christian worldview. For example, it was a debate in San Diego between Rabbi Wolpe and Christopher Hitchens on whether religion is a good thing. And Hitchens said, you know, look at all the stuff that people have done in the name of Christianity. The guy happened to be a rabbi. Thank you, Rabbi, for defending Christianity in that case. But anyway, he said, here's the difference. If an atheist does that, they're not breaking their worldview. I mean, but if a Christian does these things, you know, it's obviously against everything that their founder stood for. Jesus was a pacifist. He said, love your enemies. So the fact that people have done stupid and horrible things in the name of Christianity, we have to deal with that. But I think it's better to establish what's true first, and then say, see how this is inconsistent? That's why we don't do those things. And I apologize that people did. By the way, another thing is be careful how you do this. For example, I think we should take responsibility for the Crusades. We should take responsibility for the things that Christians have done, even though we didn't do them. I think that's the honorable, humble thing to do. I appreciate what Daniel did. I appreciate what Nehemiah did. In Nehemiah chapter 1, he says, we. Look at the prayer. He said, we did this. We did this. And Nehemiah didn't do any of those things. Look in Daniel chapter 9. Daniel says, we. He says, we. And, you know, as a young Christians, don't listen to this. But as a fellowship, we did some things that we're not totally proud of, right? All right. But say, we did that. Don't say they did that. Say, we did that. And then say, we're sorry that we did that. So I think the humble thing to do is to not say, well, those people weren't Christians. Just to say, I'm sorry that that happened. That's not consistent with what Christians teach. So setting an example of being humble, even accepting responsibility for things that you didn't do, I think is a good policy. And I think it's biblical. Okay? Anyway, I've got energy. I mean, I'm willing to keep going, but it seems...
You have a website, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so what we can do is, if you're going to be at church on Sunday...
I am going to be at church on Sunday. Oh, you mean them.
Yes.
I hope you'll be at church on Sunday.
We're going to have John put his website up. So I want you to go check out that. And then in the back, John's got some books and some other things as well. And take some time to look at that. You can buy some things on your way out. But go ahead and check out the website because there's so much more. This was like a little bit, you know what I mean? And what he did for us today was he put so much down in a little time, and I know our heads are kind of swimming here a little bit. You might have heard a lot of things, but give it some time. Go check out the website. We'll be talking more about this, and pick up a book or two on your way out. And thank you guys so much, and thank you again, John. This was a great night. So, amen.
Thanks.